Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Senate Finance. Present at the table are Senators Bishop, Dunleavy, McKinnon, Hoffman, and Olson. Senator Richicki is not feeling well. He has succumbed to the capital crud like we all have had at one time or the other. Today we're going to have an overview regarding PERS-TERS, and we have a number of people from admin and revenue here to do that very thing. We've got PowerPoint, some slides to get through. Is there any business that the members wanted to bring before the committee before we get started? Hearing none. Who's going to be presenting? Is it you, Commissioner Hoffbeck? Or? Okay. Are you? Oh, Commissioner Fisher. You know, we haven't met yet. Come right up. Okay, come on up. If you guys could state your name and affiliation for the record, and then just you have the floor. Also, we'll probably interrupt you for questions if that's all right as we go along. Senator McKinnon?
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, I didn't know if you introduced everyone at the table.
I did, actually, yeah.
Thank you.
So, go ahead.
Thank you. We're pleased to be here. I'm Commissioner Fisher from the Department of Administration. Commissioner Hoffbeck from Revenue is with me, as well as others from our staff in the audience. Moving to slide one of the presentation, just in terms of our agenda for the day, we'll spend a few minutes talking about some background on PERS and TERS, and then we'll discuss the investment, and finally we'll discuss the $3 billion investment that was made through SB 119 and HB 385. Looking on slide two, in terms of the background facts, we thought we'd talk a little bit about membership, organization, the balance sheet, some health cost trends, and funding ratio and employer contribution information. And pleased to take questions at any point during the presentation. In terms of membership for PERS, There is a typo on this page. It says that the numbers are correct. Well, I'm sorry, I've got slightly different numbers, forgive me. But in terms of active, rather than 74%, it's roughly 52% are 53% are of the current active members are in the defined benefit, and the balance are in defined contribution. This does represent at 46%, this represents a fairly substantial growth in the percentage of our employees that fall in the defined contribution tier. It is important to note that this, while we call it the defined contribution, it actually consists of a defined contribution pension plan combined with a defined benefit health care plan. And as you probably know, one of the priorities for the coming year for my department is actually to adopt a retiree health plan for these members. We continue to see a fairly significant retirement in our defined benefit members at about 2,000 members a year, and of course that is a large part of what's driving the movement towards a large percentage of our employees falling in the defined contribution tier. Looking at slide four, this is the similar facts for the
through the chair. Slide three. Do we know how many of these employees are actual? This is PERS we're talking about. How many of these employees are actually employees of the state as opposed to municipalities or other entities? How can we get a breakdown of that?
The figure for retirees is nearly 60%, slightly under 60% are former state employees, and the balance are municipalities. I don't have that number for active, but we can get that and get that back to you.
So roughly 60-40.
That's the current retirees.
And TERS is considered directly a state issue. We oversee the unorganized boroughs for our RAAs. But is it viewed any differently in terms of TERS? There's no TERS. Explain TERS just for a moment for everybody, please.
TERS, of course, are the teachers,
right.
And While it has generally been funded by the state, it's, I guess I may be mistaken on this, but it's my understanding that these are employees more of the local school boards rather than any state department, but we, the state has taken on the principal role of funding for that or for those employees.
So we'll get a breakdown of this other stuff?
Yes, for active members, yes.
Thank you.
Senator McCann.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know that we have been working on adopting a retiree health plan for our defined contribution folks, but I see that we have 9 retirees listed, and so I'm wondering what system you're currently using, or at least as an emergency way, how we're offering those health care benefits.
So these 9 retirees are not eligible for health care benefits yet. That's still another, a little bit over a year out into the future, and so we will have the plan in place before any employees hit that point.
Senator Bishop, did you have a question? Oh. Senator Dunleavy, somebody raised your hand over there. Guess not. Go ahead, gentlemen.
Senator, you see, in terms of slide 4, you see a similar breakdown. Obviously, the percentage of retirees of active members in the DC plan is slightly less. We have continued to see a potential large number of retirees in the TERS pool, and we've been expecting that for a couple of years now. The past year, the number of retirees was approximately 500, but once that there's a group of individuals there that we anticipate could lead to figures kind of in the similar to the PERS in the neighborhood of a couple thousand employees a year that could retire, and we would expect that to happen sometime in the near term.
Go ahead, Senator McCann.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The first question, university is not included in this particular group, so is that a separate pension? And if so, do we have any numbers on contribution that the state makes outside of the university budget, or is it all included in the university budget?
I don't know where that it hits, to be honest with you. I'll get back to you. It is a separate, it's not included in these numbers, and it is a separate, but I don't know where those numbers reside. I'll get
back to
you.
Talking about the ORP plan? Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, on the TERS specifically, and I think it holds true on the PERS, for the municipalities and local governments who negotiate those benefits, do we have any say, or are we just paying the costs of whatever is negotiated?
For the benefits portion of the...
If you want to go ahead and get a lifeline, that's why I'll take a break. Senator McKinnon, could you repeat the question and welcome Mr. Boucher?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. I'm trying to establish how much control over costs we have in negotiations for benefits that the state is providing state dollars to.
Through the Chair, Senator McKinnon, the local school districts subscribe to the TERS plan. So in terms of a benefits package, the state has control over that. However, the state does not negotiate wages, for example, for the employee. Does that answer your question?
Mr. Chairman, if I might?
Mm-hmm.
We don't negotiate health care coverage either, correct?
Correct.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Dunleavy?
Yeah, and those benefits can also extend to personal leave days and some other benefits, but yeah, it's if you're active, it's negotiated by the local educational unit, whether it's a municipality or REAA, with no limits put on by the state.
Okay. Go ahead, Mr. Fisher.
I'm moving to slide five. This outlines the basic organization of the PERS and TERS. There's the Alaska Retirement Management Board that has nine members. Happy to discuss the details of that membership, but in essence, the ARM board sets the investment policy, adopts asset allocations, adopts the actuarial assumptions, approves investment managers, and reviews performance. In addition, of course, the Department of Revenue, and they'll speak in a moment, is responsible for investing the assets, and they have an investment advisory committee that helps them with that. The Department of Administration is responsible for administering the pension and the health benefits. There's a fairly large number of pension plans and health plans that are administered at this time, including beyond PERS and TERS and the various both defined benefit and defined contribution plans. There's the judicial retirement system and a variety of health plans, including both for retirees and for active employees, as well as the supplemental annuity pension and deferred compensation plans, as well as the National Guard. It's a fairly complicated set of responsibilities, and a significant set of issues arise. As you know, we also administer the third-party work with a third-party administrator to administer our health care plans. I guess I'll just say that in the past, from time to time, there are issues, and we'd be pleased if an issue comes to the attention of you or your staff to just contact me or my staff, and we'll be happy to help you with any issues that arise. Moving to slide six, this shows the balance sheet, and as you can see, we're a little over about $8.7 billion of unfunded liability. The funding ratio for both plans is expected by the end of this fiscal year to be over 70%. That is a substantial improvement, and I from where we were prior to the funding of the $3 billion. And I think it's appropriate to take this opportunity to thank the legislature for that. I think I can speak on behalf of all of the members of the ARM board that we appreciate the investment that's made, and feel like it was almost an unprecedented, reflecting their wisdom and courage to do that. As we met in our meetings last week, it was reported to us that we anticipate any liquidity issues being forestalled until 2040. And that's somewhere around 15 years beyond where it had been anticipated prior to the funding. So,
excuse me just a moment. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Fisher, did I hear you say that the ARM board was appreciative and thought the $3 billion was a good move?
Absolutely, and yes.
And because I read a newspaper article that was saying a little different, and so I'm glad to hear that, for the record, that the ARM board supported that $3 billion deposit.
Absolutely, and I. read the similar report, and I think that everyone, and you can read the record of the minutes of the on-board meeting, there was a universal expression of appreciation. I think different people have different views depending on the seat where they sit, but in terms of the division between the municipality and the state, but that, in my mind, is a detail, and I think on behalf of all of the on-board, I can express our gratitude and appreciation for that investment.
Senator McKinnon?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, on the article, you can't believe everything you read. The person in question that was being quoted in that particular article, somehow our office got information that that the quotes may have been correct, but it wasn't in the context in which she presented it that was presented in that particular article. And she did pass along her appreciation for the legislature and the wisdom in the appropriation. I do have a question, though, on slide 6. I notice as we go through the presentation that there's different numbers being used, and this particular number that shows up on slide 6 says the roll forward number, and so I believe later we may see one that doesn't recognize at least the $1 billion yet to go into the fund, and so I just wanted to call out that this particular rendition or anticipation of the funding ratio has yet to receive a deposit of another $1 billion separated in the same way between PERS and TERS. Is that correct, and that's the difference, and that's what you're referring to as the roll forward, or if not, could you tell us what the differences are?
The roll forward, as reflected on this page, is the anticipated assets and liabilities in both PERS and TERS as of June 30, 15, and would include both the $2 billion investment in TERS and the $1 billion investment in PERS. It would include the full $3 billion.
Senator McKinnon?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There is $1 billion yet to be deposited, though,
yes.
So this is an anticipated look at the fund. I just want to make sure that we know that on the record that it requires time to move money to do that in the best way to benefit both the pension plan and Alaskans, and so this is an estimated use of that money, and we expect March 15th or March 1st, somewhere in there, to add the last billion into the actual plan?
That's exactly right.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Moving to slide 7. Again, this is one of the major components to the unfunded liability relates to health care costs. And what you see here, if you look on the far right column, on a compounded basis, you can see that our health care costs still, as of 2014, it's still substantially higher than inflation at 9%. The last few years, however, and this is looking at the column labeled annual percentage change. On an annual basis, you can see the last few years the state has done a better job of managing the costs down, and I can report for the current fiscal year, we also anticipate that there will be a zero increase in annual costs. So this has been driven by a number of factors. Most recently, the state selected Aetna as the third-party administrator. The state did this to try to take advantage of Aetna's network. We anticipate that during the first year, during fiscal year 15, that we'll have approximately $50 million of savings versus our prior administrator. We are aware that a number of there have been some issues with Aetna in terms of their delivery of the service, and we are working aggressively with them to try to improve that impact, and will continue. But I am pleased that we've been able to bend the cost curve and at least flatten the rising cost of health care for the state. Moving to slide 8 and slide 9, these really are historical, and you can see the funding ratios that existed. This is prior to the most recent investment we've been discussing. You can see that for PERS that it was 61% We're anticipating that by June it will be over 70%. And then in slide 9, again, you can see that it was just over, for TERS, it was just over 50%. And again, we expect those to be over 70% by June. And so really quite a remarkable improvement in the funding for the plan as a result of the investment that the state has made. With that, I'll turn the presentation over to Commissioner Hoffbeck.
Senator McKinnon.
Oh, I'm sorry. This is one of my slides, too. Forgive me. I'm not done yet. Go ahead.
Commissioner, I know that we have benefits that have been established through contract negotiations. I'm wondering, as a future recipient of a retirement plan, it's in my interest as well as the people that I represent to make sure that this is 100% funded and that it's doing well. And I wonder if we have an employee contribution. I personally, not that I'm not speaking for my constituents now, but I personally would be willing to pay a monthly fee to help us out of this particular situation that we find ourselves in having a lower funded plan that we want. And I'm certainly not speaking for other Alaskans who believe that the state has promised them something and we should deliver on that promise. And the state has tried to step up with the $3 billion and do a large cash infusion. But I'm wondering if there are any employee contributions that are happening into the plan right now, which I believe there are. And if so, if you could get back to me on how much that is, and then how does that come about? Is it a negotiated piece, or are these plans locked in so whatever was negotiated in the past now just stays the same in the future?
It is locked in and then reflected in our collective bargaining agreements and other employee payments. Do you want to talk about how that was established?
I believe that the contribution rate has been the same since the inception of the plan. I'd have to confirm that, but I can't remember the exact percentage. But essentially, yes, it has been locked in for the life of the plan, is my understanding.
Go ahead.
So on slide 10, this shows the contribution rate for the additional full contribution, if you will. You'll see that it varied over time. There's been a number of factors that have driven that, including some of the issues with prior actuaries as I think you know, as the rate began to exceed 50%, the state stepped in and capped the rates for school districts at just over 12.5% and for municipalities and at 22% in terms of their contributions. And you can see then that very steep drop in 2016 for both PERS and TERS reflects the investment of the $3 billion that was made.
Commissioner Hoff, Senator McKinnon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had sent a list of questions so as not to surprise anyone that might be here today. And one of the questions was on the termination studies. Local municipalities have approached different offices asking for relief so that they can manage their budgets differently. And I was told that during the presentation that there would be some conversations on the questions that I asked. So I haven't heard anything on the termination study. I'm not sure if it would come later or if it fits, Commissioner, inside of your remarks.
Sure.
But
I'm happy to address that. We, like you, have heard from a number of the municipalities about the challenge that termination studies impose on municipalities in making rational decisions, that sometimes the termination studies result in a liability that makes what otherwise would be a good decision a challenge for them. And so we have been working with the governor's office and particularly with OMB, to evaluate different approaches. We're in the midst of studying those right now and trying to find a balance between providing the municipalities the flexibility that they need to make good decisions while still ensuring the viability and of the fund. And so I think we expect before too much longer to come forward with some proposals to be considered, although we don't have something to present at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm wondering, to play devil's advocate here, that the administration has brought forward a budget that eliminates many positions across the state, and I'm wondering if we've done a study at all to know how that will affect the PERS and TERS system if we lose 300 employees that are currently contributing.
We have not done a termination study at this time. As a technical matter, it's not mandated by the rules because we're not eliminating entire classifications, but and we have not done a study formally to evaluate that impact.
Go ahead, Senator Hoffman, or excuse me, Commissioner Hoffman.
For the chair, I'm going to take over at this point in time and talk a little bit about the investment side. Commissioner Fisher talked about the admin side of the PERS TERS program. The Alaska Retirement Management Board is the fiduciary for the PERS, the TERS, the judicial, the military retirement plans, as well as the supplemental benefit system and the deferred comp plan. And per Alaska statute, the ARM Board is housed within the Department of Revenue, and the department provides the staffing for the board. Slide 12. The ARM Board is responsible for approximately $28 billion in assets across 18 different investment plans. Most of the public attention focuses on two plans, PERS and TERS, which we're talking about today, but there's also secondary, there's the judicial and the military benefit, defined benefit plans, which have assets of about $23 billion. Also under ARM Board investment authority is the defined contribution retirement plans for PERS and TERS, which, as Commissioner Fisher said, are growing rapidly and now total over $1 billion, as well as two other plans that are specific to the state, the SBS accounts and the deferred compensation plans, which total over $4 billion. All of those come under the ARM Board as far as investment decisions.
Senator McKinnon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, I see the judicial retirement system in here, and I don't need it today, but I'm wondering what their status is for a funding ratio and if they're underfunded or not.
I will have to get that to you. Going to slide 13. In investing the assets each year, the ARM Board receives capital market assumptions from McCallan & Associates, who's the ARM Board's investment consultant. The assumptions include expected rates of return for each asset class over the next 10 years, as well as expected standard deviation on those returns and the standard deviation on various asset mixes. Based on that information, an efficient frontier is developed, which shows the likely return and standard deviation for those various asset class mixes. And that frontier, along with the recommendations from the Chief Investment Officer, our consultant Callan, and other investment advisors, the board adopts a strategic investment plan and the target asset allocations. And on this slide, you can see what those target allocations are. Notice that approximately 50% resides in equities, between domestic and global equities in both PERS and overall. This is actually PERS allocations here, but TERS is very similar to it. So it's invested relatively aggressively. And then you can note between the two slides here, the actual asset allocation and the target allocation, it's invested pretty close to the asset target allocations that were provided by the ARM Board. And that comes just from that variance can come from length of time on investments and returns on investments during a year before rebalancing, but it is invested in fashion as recommended by the ARM board. Going to slide 14. This is an interesting slide for historical purposes. It shows that this shows 226 years of returns from the U.S. stock market, and it's put into essentially a bell curve here. That was prepared by the board's investment consultant, and you'll notice that after the sell-off in 2008, we've had 6 years of returns that have been on the positive side of the bell curve. That's substantial. So after a 37% downturn, we've had 6 years of fairly robust returns. And I noticed that the 2013 return actually was 32.4%. So we've done well over the last 6 years. We all suffered a lot in 2008 when the market went down, but it's recovered nicely, and we've recovered much more than what we lost in 2008. Slide 15 gives a 20-year perspective on the returns of PERS and TERS, and relates it also to the permanent fund and the S&P 500, just for a comparison of returns. One of the things that tends to be flagged when people look at these particular returns is the S&P 500 is outperforming our actively managed accounts, and the question is, are we getting what we paid for with active management? But what's reflected here is if S&P 500 would be a 100% equity investment portfolio, which quite simply is more risk than the state or any other retirement fund or endowment fund would typically take on. And so the S&P, comparing it directly to S&P 500 is not a really good comparison, because that's just a higher risk investment portfolio than what the state would take on. And then when our investments are actually compared against their benchmarks within their asset classes, they perform at or above their benchmarks. And if there's any that perform below benchmarks for a period of time, they're put on a watch list. If they stay down, we'll replace them with other fund managers.
Senator McKinnon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, the Department of Revenue has done an excellent job in the last 5 years in managing the people's money. In fact, a shout out to the past administration on the returns that we've received over that five-year period. I'm wondering, as we look into the future, whether we should consider a corporation that handles these assets. I think you said earlier $23 billion of assets right now housed in the Department of Revenue, managed in some ways. Is the department considering a corporation that might save us money, or have you thought about that conversation?
We hadn't taken it on as a serious conversation until we saw the question, and we kind of look back on it. And I think back in 1990, there was actually some legislation that was introduced to try and form a corporation for the retirement fund that did not pass. It's been looked at a couple of times over the years since then, and it was never found to be an efficient way of managing any more efficient than the status quo. Would require additional administrative overhead. We would see salary inflation within the staff, because they wouldn't be under the constraints of the state's salary parameters, and then we would see some redundancy in staff. We actually are able to use staff for not only investing ARM board assets, but also other state assets efficiently by keeping them all under one roof. So have we looked at it seriously? No. First blush, I would think it probably wouldn't save us, but I think it's worth us looking at. So,
Commissioner, do you support the permanent fund?
I do support the permanent fund.
And those are not GF dollars. They pay all of their dollars straight from permanent fund earnings. I'm just wondering whether something could be had for the pension system to do that too, for management. So I'd be interested in the analysis that you might have to look at the cost of that administrative overhead.
I think it's a project worth looking at. We will do that.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Slide 16 talks about it's introduction to Senate Bill 119 and HB 385, where the $3 billion appropriation was made into the pension funds. SB 119, HB 385 was a substantive law relating to the retirement systems, and of course SB 119 was the appropriation bill that put the $1 billion into PERS and the $2 billion into TERS. HB 385 did two things in particular. It provided that once all liabilities were paid, any excess assets would be deposited into the general fund. And then it also required the actuarial method, that's hard to say, known as level percent of payment, based on amortization of the past service liability for a closed fund of 25 years. So it extended, it went to a level percent of pay and extended the amortization period for reaching a full, fully funded pension plan. And as I said before, SB 119 put $1 billion into PERS and $2 billion into TERS. As far as the investment of those monies, the former Commissioner of Revenue made a decision which I think was prudent in that they would not put all of the money in at one time. Senator McKinnon actually alluded to that already, that it allows for a much more systematic investment of the funds in a way that should ultimately give us more a better asset allocation and better fund management. It also was, I think, at least in part, a reflection of what happened in 2008 when we put all of the money in at once and the market went down, and that caused a lot of angst. When the commissioner made that decision, we were in a high market. We're still in a high market. The market was frothy. It was going up and down, and nobody knew how secure it was. And so I think it was prudent to do it the way it has. And I think when you see the numbers, it's actually worked out well to do these in the three tranches. Slide 18. 18. At the actually, go back one slide. Slide 17. On this slide, you see the PERS transfers and the dates of the transfers. The $1 billion into PERS, of course, $333 million in three tranches. The July transfer has made about 0.5%. The November 13th transfers actually made a little bit more, a little over almost 0.7%, and that's because the market was a little bit more robust at the end of the year than it was earlier in the year. Next slide. Slide 18 breaks the TERS pension down into two separate slides. At the suggestion of the actuary, it was split between the TERS pension and the TERS health trust. So with $1,662 million going into the TERS pension fund and $337 million into TERS health trust. On this first slide, you'll see the result of the first two installments in the pension trust. Again, a similar pattern to what happened in the PERS. Next slide. And TERS, and again in the TERS health, the same pattern. And then finally, on slide 20. You can see the total of all of the deposits so far and the relative returns to date. And with that, we would open it up for questions.
Questions from the committee? Senator McKinnon, did you have a question?
Mr. Chairman, some of the issues that were brought out in the article that we previously talked about was the decision to go to a flat percentage versus, is it cash payout? Is that the correct, or the cash, fixed cash amount? So I don't know if you have any comments on that or if the administration is proposing any of that. I know that we're going to pay, in approximate numbers, over $200 million this year to meet that percentage obligation. And it's a huge cost driver in a budget that is very tight. And so I'm wondering if you've run the numbers actuarially to see if another cash infusion is appropriate, or because of the downturn in revenue that we're coming in, it's more valuable to retain that that money in savings account versus using it. I believe we're going to have a lost opportunity if we don't look at it hard right now. We're looking at a $3.5 billion revenue shortfall prior to July 1st of this year, and then as we look out, if prices stay low, we're looking at another $3.5 billion to $4 billion. So I think that our savings are being used how Alaska intended them to be used, but I just wonder whether we've really looked at the numbers and ran them to see if another cash infusion would be the right way to go now, because I don't think in 3 or 4 months going forward that that is an option. So that option will be off the table.
Through the chair, Senator McKinnon, just to kind of put in perspective what the effect of the decisions that were made last year, if we were still under the old system without the two bills that were passed last year, we'd be paying $1.175 billion this year for our required payment into PERS and TERS, and now we're paying $256 million. The wisdom of that stands out in relationship to our budget shortfall even more so than it would have even in a stable budget. I mean, that really gave us a substantial window moving forward that we would not have if that action had not been taken. As far as adding another billion this year, of course, that has to be weighed against all of the other needs for that $1 billion going forward. But to put it in perspective, for FY17, if we were to make another an FY16 an additional PERS, $1 billion in the PERS, it would reduce our PERS payment from $117 million down to $55 million. So it's substantial, but whether the billion or the $60 million is the drive, you know, $60 million going forward or billion now, it's a decision that would need to be made.
Senator McKinnon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are there, I already know the answer to this, but I want it on the record. Are there any new assumptions that the people of Alaska need to know about regarding either interest rate returns or actuarial recommendations to modify our plan? And if those were implemented, what would that do to the plan?
Let me answer that question, if I may. Looking backwards, certainly we constantly upgrade our actuarial assumptions. In the past, the end of last year, the actuary came forward and made a number of recommendations. The largest impact had to do with the mortality rate, and then there was also some impact associated with the different assumptions around termination rate as well as the salary scale. Those assumptions decreased the funding ratio by about 2%. Of course, these assumptions were prior to the investments being made. At this stage, I think we're implementing the actuarial recommendations. The actuarial assumptions and those that have been presented today reflect these recommendations. And I'm not aware of additional recommendations that are being made by the actuaries.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The mortality rate, I'm not sure if I'm going to get it right. People are living longer.
That's right.
And so if I look at slide number 6 on your roll forward then, has that new assumption been calculated in there?
In terms of it's my understanding, I'll confirm this, in terms of the unfunded liability, that assumption includes these revised mortality rates, and that actuarial assumption includes an adjustment to the mortality rate than what had been previously in the plan.
And that's done, I think, every 3 years.
So. Right.
Senator McKinnon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If you could check that and confirm and get back to me that if we reduced our increased that percentage rate and it caused a reduction, I just want to be confident that's great if it's already calculated in there. It still assumes an interest rate of return over a 30-year period of 6%?
8%.
8%. And the norm on large funds, I believe, is lower than that. But we still can support it, I believe, because you've shown us the 30-year rate of return. So it seems fair, as long as we're still maintaining it over a 30-year period, to be able to keep that elevated. But it would increase our unfunded liability if we actually reduce the percentage, correct?
That's right.
That's correct.
So, Mr. Chairman, the only reason I'm bringing it out is this is all based on a group of assumptions. And so when we look at 71% funding or 77% funding, we need to be very careful with how we react. But it's great that people are living longer. Thank you.
Senator Dunleavy.
Thank you, through the Chair. There's been periodically there's been discussions about going back to a defined benefit program or a hybrid program. What's the position of the administration on, given our fiscal situation, on revisiting that concept?
I don't know that the administration has taken an official position on it at this point in time, but an unofficial position, I don't think we can afford it.
That was an unofficial position.
It was an unofficial position.
Okay.
Another question?
Go ahead.
Has there been any buyout concepts contemplated to try and remove folks from the rolls?
When you say buyout, are you referring to active employees, a early retirement, or are you referring to there's sometimes pension plans look at offering people a cash in lieu of a stream? Is it the latter?
Yes.
That has been looked at from time to time in the past. The issue that typically, and as we've talked to the actuaries, that creates some challenge there is there's an adverse selection bias, meaning that those people who may perceive that they will not take advantage of a long-term pension benefit will take the buyout, and those who, because of their health and longevity, perceive that they will take advantage don't. And so it's hard to get that right. And historically, I think, as when we've looked at that in the past, the counsel we received is that it's probably not a prudent path to take.
One last question. There was a discussion earlier in the presentation about You have negotiations at a local level for both PERS and TERS. There's no caps on those negotiations. And once those negotiations take place, for example, in the old Tier 1, it was three highest years of individuals would be calculated for retirement, et cetera. Has the administration discussed or contemplated any types of caps on negotiations at the local level? For state employees and PERS, TERS?
Through the chair, the negotiations at the local level, they don't negotiate their retirement benefits. They negotiate their wages and health benefits at that point in time. Certainly the wage component does roll into the retirement side, but no, there hasn't been anything contemplated about as far as trying to control that.
Any further questions? Hearing none, thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate it. Any other questions or comments or anything come before the committee? Hearing nothing, we are adjourned.